The stone floor of the cathedral leached the warmth straight through the thin soles of Beatrice's slippers. But the cold wasn't what made her shiver. It was the sound of Arthur's laugh, a short, wet exhale that echoed off the vaulted stone the second her first tear fell. He didn't look at her like a bride. He looked at her like a captured fox. Most women would have wept harder. Beatrice just stopped. She wiped her cheek, turned on her heavy heel, and locked eyes with the man holding the rings, his brother. The air in St. Jude's tasted of stale incense and damp wool. It was a suffocating flavor, thick enough to coat the back of the throat. Beatrice stood at the altar, drowning in 40 pounds of imported ivory silk, the corset pulled tight enough by her mother's frantic maid to ensure a 19-inch waist dug a rigid line of pain into her lower ribs with every shallow breath. She was a commodity dressed up and polished, standing at the edge of the precipice. Beside her stood Arthur, the Duke of Westmoreland. He smelled of cloves, expensive pomade, and absolute certainty. He hadn't looked at her since she arrived at his side. His attention was fixed on a point somewhere above the bishop's balding head, his profile sharp and disinterested. The bishop droned on his voice, a monotonous hum that blended with the rhythmic patter of November rain against the stained glass. In the front pew, Beatrice could hear the heavy, wet breathing of her father. She knew without looking that he was sweating a thin sheen of grease across his forehead as he waited for the ink to dry on the social contract that would save him from debtor's prison. She was the collateral. The pretty, quiet daughter traded to a duke who needed a respectable womb to produce his heirs. It wasn't supposed to be an emotional affair. She knew the rules of her world. You traded youth and beauty for titles and security. Love was a ridiculous notion peddled by cheap novelists meant for servant girls and lonely spinsters. Beatrice had resigned herself to a life of comfortable, cold indifference. She had prepared for Arthur's arrogance. She had prepared for his neglect. But as the bishop reached the crucial moment, the exchange of vows, a sudden unbidden wave of pure exhaustion hit her. It wasn't grief. It wasn't fear. It was just the crushing weight of the charade. The months of pretending to smile at his dull anecdotes, the forced curtsies, the way his hands felt like cold marble when he touched her waist. The tension behind her eyes snapped. A single tear spilled over her lower lashes. It was a hot, humiliating betrayal of her own control. It tracked down her heavily powdered cheek, cutting a wet ravine through the chalky white makeup. She sniffed a tiny, pathetic sound in the cavernous quiet of the cathedral. Arthur turned his head. He looked down at the tear, and then he laughed. It wasn't a booming guffaw. It was a scoff. A small, sharp expulsion of air through his nose, accompanied by a slight curling of his upper lip. He leaned in, his breath hot and smelling faintly of the brandy he'd undoubtedly had for breakfast. "Oh, spare me the theatrics, Beatrice," he whispered, his voice a dry rasp meant only for her ears. "We both know you aren't weeping for joy, and we both know you don't have the luxury of weeping for sorrow. Dry your face. You're making a fool of yourself." He didn't hand her a handkerchief. He didn't offer a reassuring squeeze of her hand. He just looked at her with an expression of profound, tired boredom. He had won the prize, and now he was already annoyed by the maintenance it required. Something broke inside Beatrice. It wasn't a loud shattering. It was a quiet, metallic snap, like the mainspring of a pocket watch giving out. The fear evaporated. The desperate need to appease her father to secure the future burned away in a sudden, icy flood of spite. She looked at Arthur. Really looked at him, at the faint burst blood vessels around his nose, at the cold, dead blue of his eyes. He was a tyrant in a tailored coat, and he was going to spend the next 40 years slowly grinding her into dust for his own amusement. She breathed in. The air tasted of dust and defiance. Beatrice lifted her gloved hand and wiped the tear away. The rough Brussels lace scratched her skin, leaving a red welt. She didn't look back at the altar. She didn't look at her gasping father in the front row. She turned 90 degrees to her left. Standing there holding a velvet cushion with two heavy gold bands was Thomas. Thomas was a shadow. He was the younger brother by 4 years, a man who had spent his entire life standing precisely 2 steps behind the Duke of Westmoreland. If Arthur was carved from marble, Thomas was whittled from rough, knotty wood. He lacked the symmetry of his brother. His nose had been broken in a hunting accident and never set quite right. His hair was a darker, muddier brown, constantly escaping the confines of his collar. He wore a cravat that looked as though it had been tied in the dark by a man with a headache. He didn't smell like cloves. As Beatrice stepped toward him, the heavy silk of her gown dragging across the stone, she caught the scent of him. Pipe tobacco, leather polish, the faint metallic tang of ink. Thomas's dark eyes widened a fraction as she stopped in front of him. He didn't drop the cushion, but his knuckles went white. Beatrice, he murmured, his voice a low, gravelly rumble that seemed to vibrate in the floorboards. Come with me, she said. It wasn't a request. She reached out and grabbed his wrist. His skin was burning hot against the cold silk of her gloves. She felt the heavy thudding rhythm of his pulse beneath her thumb. He hesitated for a fraction of a second, glancing over her shoulder at Arthur, who was currently staring at Beatrice's back with an expression of slack-jawed confusion. Then Thomas looked back at her. He didn't ask questions. He let her pull him. They walked right past the altar, past the sputtering bishop, and ducked into the narrow, arched doorway of the sacristy. The heavy oak door swung shut behind them, cutting off the sudden rising hiss of whispers from the congregation. The sacristy was dim, lit only by a single high window that let in the gray November light. It smelled of old paper and beeswax. Beatrice let go of his wrist and leaned against a heavy oak table, her chest heaving against the unyielding constraints of her corset. Her hands were shaking violently. Thomas stood in the center of the room. He carefully set the velvet cushion down on a stack of hymnals. He didn't speak. He just watched her, his hands shoved deep into the pockets of his trousers. I can't do it, Beatrice choked out. The adrenaline was beginning to curdle into panic in her stomach. I will die in that house. He will kill me slowly. He usually does, Thomas said quietly. Beatrice looked up. The cynicism in his voice matched the bitter taste in her own mouth. Thomas didn't love his brother. The aristocracy liked to pretend their bloodlines were bound by loyalty, but Beatrice knew the truth. Inheritance was a zero-sum game, and Thomas was the loser. He lived on a modest allowance, managing the secondary estates constantly subjected to Arthur's petty tyrannies. Marry me instead. The words fell out of her mouth before she could weigh them. They hit the stone floor like lead weights. Thomas froze. He pulled his hands out of his pockets. You're hysterical. I am perfectly lucid, she snapped, stepping toward him. The rustle of her dress sounded like a wildfire in the small room. My father's creditors will accept any aristocratic marriage. They don't care if it's the Duke or the Duke's brother as long as the debts are guaranteed. You have the Blackwood estate in your name, don't you? It's a sheep farm in Yorkshire, Beatrice. It's not Westmoreland. I don't care about Westmoreland. I care about not waking up every morning wishing I'd swallowed arsenic the night before. She pointed a trembling gloved finger at the door. He laughed at me. He looked at me like I was a mare with a bad tooth. Thomas looked away, his jaw tightening. A muscle ticked in his cheek. He walked over to the window, staring out at the rain. If we do this, Thomas said, his voice stripped of any polite veneer, we will be pariahs. Arthur will cut me off entirely. Your family will be a laughingstock. Society will bar its doors to us. We will have nothing but a drafty manor house in the north and the clothes on our backs. Will he be there? She asked. Thomas looked back over his shoulder. Arthur. No. He hates Yorkshire. Complains the air smells like dirt. Beatrice let out a harsh, breathless laugh. Then it sounds like paradise. She walked up behind him. She didn't touch him, but she stood close enough to feel the heat radiating off his wool coat. Do you despise me, Thomas? He turned around. He looked down at her, his dark eyes tracing the harsh line of her jaw, the smudged powder on her cheek, the furious, terrified defiance in her gaze. It wasn't a romantic look. It was an assessment. He was weighing the cost of ruin against the pleasure of taking the one thing his brother had claimed as his own. "No," Thomas said softly. "I don't despise you." He reached past her and picked up the velvet cushion. He plucked the smaller gold band from the indentation in the velvet. He held it between his thumb and forefinger, examining it. "It won't be a love match," Thomas warned her, his eyes cold and pragmatic. "I am not a hero. I am a man who is sick to death of watching a tyrant take whatever he pleases." "I don't need a hero," Beatrice replied, lifting her chin. "I need an accomplice." Thomas's mouth twitched. It wasn't a smile, but it was the closest thing she had seen to one all morning. "Then let us go commit a crime." The heavy oak door of the sacristy groaned as Thomas pulled it open. The noise in the cathedral hit them like a physical blow. The polite whispering had escalated into a chaotic hum. People were standing in the pews, craning their necks. Her father was leaning heavily on his walking stick, his face a mottled, dangerous purple, and standing exactly where they had left him, looking like a thundercloud wrapped in fine tailoring, was Arthur. Beatrice stepped out first. She didn't lower her eyes. She kept her spine rigid, letting the heavy train of her dress drag over the stone. Thomas walked half a step behind her, his limp slightly more pronounced now, his face a mask of absolute indifference. The crowd parted as they approached the altar. The bishop took a step back, clutching his prayer book to his chest, as if it could protect him from the sheer scandal unfolding before him. "What is the meaning of this?" Arthur barked. The polished veneer was entirely gone. His voice echoed harsh and ugly off the stone arches. He grabbed Beatrice's arm, his fingers digging bruisingly into her bicep through the silk. "Get back to your place." Before Beatrice could flinch, a large, calloused hand clamped down on Arthur's wrist. Thomas didn't shout. He didn't flex. He simply applied pressure. The knuckles of his hand turned white, and slowly, agonizingly, Arthur's fingers uncurled from Beatrice's arm. "Do not touch her," Thomas said. His voice was quiet, but it carried. Arthur stared at his younger brother in utter shock. The shock quickly curdled into a furious sneer. "Have you lost your mind, Tommy? Let go of me before I have you thrown out into the mud." "You don't own the church, Arthur," Thomas replied, stepping smoothly between his brother and Beatrice. He turned his back on the Duke, a profound gesture of disrespect that caused an audible gasp from the front pew. Thomas looked at the bishop. The old man was shaking, his eyes darting frantically between the two brothers. "We are ready to continue," Thomas said clearly. "But you will be directing the vows to me." "My lord," the bishop stammered, sweat pooling in his collar. I cannot. The bans were read for the Duke of Westmoreland. This is highly irregular. It is scandalous. It is a legal transfer of a marriage license, provided both parties consent. Thomas interrupted, smoothly pulling a folded piece of parchment from his inner coat pocket. He slapped it onto the altar. "The license is made out to the House of Westmoreland. I carry the name as well as he does. Read the vows, Bishop, or I will find a magistrate who will, and the church will lose the rather substantial donation I intended to make this afternoon." It was a bluff. Beatrice knew Thomas didn't have the money for a substantial donation, but the bishop didn't know that. Arthur stepped forward, his face contorted with rage. "This is a farce. She is mine. The contract is signed. The financial contract is signed." Beatrice spoke up. Her voice trembled, but she forced the words out past the lump of terror in her throat. "The spiritual contract requires my verbal consent, which you do not have, Your Grace." She turned her back on Arthur. She faced Thomas. The silence in the cathedral was absolute. It was the silence of 100 people holding their breath, watching a carriage careen toward a cliff edge. Thomas held out his hand. He didn't wear gloves. His hand was rough, the knuckles scarred from old fights and manual labor. There was ink stained deep into the cuticle of his index finger. Beatrice placed her hand in his. His grip was firm. It wasn't gentle, but it was solid. It was the grip of a man pulling someone over a wall. Proceed, Thomas ordered the bishop. The bishop swallowed hard. With trembling hands, he opened the book. He skipped the preamble. He went straight to the binding words. His voice cracked as he asked the question. I do, Thomas said. The words hit the cold air like a hammer striking an anvil. I do? Beatrice echoed. Her voice sounded thin, frail, but the finality of it sent a shockwave through her own body. Thomas took the ring. The heavy gold band meant for a duke. He slid it onto Beatrice's finger. It was cold, and it was slightly too big, hanging loosely on her slender knuckle. She took the second ring from him. It was meant for Arthur's manicured fingers. She pushed it onto Thomas's rough, scarred finger. It stuck at the knuckle, and she had to force it over the joint. He didn't flinch. I pronounce you man and wife, the bishop whispered, looking thoroughly sick. You may kiss the bride, Thomas muttered, finishing the man's sentence for him. He didn't wait for permission. He stepped into her space. He didn't tilt her chin up delicately. He simply ducked his head and pressed his mouth to hers. It was an awkward, terrible kiss. Their noses bumped. Her teeth scraped against his bottom lip. He smelled of peppermint and the sharp tang of cheap gin. It lacked any grace, any romance. It was the messy, desperate sealing of a pact made in a moment of pure madness. When he pulled away, he looked down at her. His chest was rising and falling rapidly. For a second beneath the cynical, hard exterior, Beatrice saw the same terrified realization that was clawing at her own insides. What have we just done? Come! Thomas said, his voice rough. He didn't offer his arm. He grabbed her hand again, his fingers lacing tightly through hers. He turned, pulling her with him. They walked down the aisle. The faces of the congregation blurred into a smear of pale, shocked expressions. Somewhere to her left, Beatrice heard her mother let out a sharp, high-pitched whine before slumping into her aunt's shoulder. Her father was staring at her with a look of murderous hatred. Behind them at the altar, Arthur stood in frozen disbelief. The sneer had vanished, replaced by the ugly, slack-jawed reality of a man who had just been robbed in broad daylight. Beatrice kept her eyes on the heavy wooden doors at the end of the aisle. Her corset bit into her ribs. Her feet ached. The ring felt heavy and alien on her hand. Thomas pushed the doors open. The cold, wet November wind hit them instantly, whipping Beatrice's veil around her face and stinging her cheeks. The rain was coming down in sheets, turning the cobblestone street into a gray, muddy river. They stepped out into the storm, leaving the suffocating heat and the shocked silence of the cathedral behind them. There was no carriage waiting for them. There was no cheering crowd. There was only the rain, the cold, and the terrifying, uncharted reality of the ruin they had just chosen. The rain did not care that she was a bride. It lashed against them in vicious sideways sheets, instantly plastering the 40 pounds of imported ivory silk to Beatrice's legs. Within 10 steps, the hem of her gown was heavy with brown street mud, dragging behind her like a waterlogged corpse. Keep moving. Thomas grunted, his hand still locked around hers. He pulled her down the cobblestone street away from the imposing shadow of St. Jude's. The wind howled, snatching the veil from Beatrice's hair. She let it go. It fluttered away into the gray afternoon like a surrendered flag landing in a puddle of horse urine. She didn't look back. Her thin slippers were useless. Freezing water seeped through the soles, numbing her toes instantly. She was shivering so violently her teeth rattled a sharp clicking sound, lost beneath the roar of the downpour and the clatter of passing carriages. Thomas dragged her toward the corner of a busy intersection, holding his free arm up to hail a hackney cab. 3 passed them by the drivers, taking one look at the soaking, mud-streaked woman in a ruined wedding gown and the grim-faced man beside her and whipping their horses faster. Damn it! Thomas hissed. He tasted rain and soot. He dropped her hand and stepped directly into the street, placing himself in the path of a rickety black cab. The horse reared with frantic whinny hooves striking the wet stone. The driver cursed violently, cracking his whip against the side of the cab. Are you mad? The driver screamed down at them, his face hidden behind a sodden wool cap. North Station! Thomas yelled over the rain, yanking the carriage door open. I have silver! The driver hesitated, his eyes narrowing at Beatrice's ruined finery. Thomas didn't wait for permission. He grabbed Beatrice by the waist. His hands were large, and even through the thick, wet silk and rigid whalebone corset, she felt the sheer functional strength of him as he practically hoisted her into the carriage. She collapsed onto the cracked leather seat. It smelled intensely of wet dog stale ale and old dust. It was the best thing she had ever smelled. Thomas climbed in behind her and slammed the door shut. The carriage lurched forward, throwing Beatrice against the wooden wall. She gasped, the corset driving a brutal line of agony into her battered ribs. Inside the dim cab, the silence between them was suddenly deafening, punctuated only by the rhythmic squeak of a loose wheel and the drumming rain. They were entirely alone. Beatrice hugged herself, her teeth chattering uncontrollably. The chill was setting into her marrow. She looked at Thomas. He was dripping wet, his dark hair plastered to his forehead, his cheap cravat a sodden gray mess around his throat. He was staring at his left hand, at the heavy ornate gold ring of the Duke of Westmoreland. He slowly curled his hand into a fist, the metal catching the faint light from the window. Then he looked up at her. His dark eyes were bloodshot exhaustion already bleeding through the adrenaline. "He will freeze our accounts before sunset," Thomas said, his voice flat, devoid of any romantic reassurances. "Your father will disown you. Arthur will likely hire men to drag us back, if only to annul the marriage and throw me in the fleet for theft."
"Then we must be far away before sunset," Beatrice replied. Her voice shook, but she kept her chin level. "The mail coach leaves at 2. It is cheap, it is brutal, and it will take 3 days to reach Yorkshire."
He leaned forward, resting his elbows on his knees, peering at her through the gloom.
"You are bleeding, Beatrice."
She blinked, confused. She looked down at her hands. Her left wrist was raw and smeared with blood. The Brussels lace glove had been torn the rough friction of Arthur's brutal grip, and Thomas's desperate pull having scraped the skin away. She touched it. It stung sharply.
"It's nothing," she whispered.
But the sight of the blood, stark red against the muddy white silk, finally broke the dam. A choked sob tore out of her throat. She clamped her hand over her mouth, terrified of weeping in front of him. She had spent a year practicing stoicism for Arthur. She didn't know how to be anything else. Thomas didn't try to comfort her. He didn't move to the seat beside her or offer empty platitudes. He simply reached into his coat, pulled out a relatively dry, faintly tobacco-scented handkerchief, and tossed it onto her lap.
"Weep if you must," he said, turning his gaze out the murky window. "You've earned the right. Just be done with it by the time we reach the station. We cannot afford to look like victims."
Beatrice clutched the rough cotton to her mouth. She closed her eyes, letting the tears fall in the rattling dark. They called it High Ridge. The name implied a certain sweeping majesty. The reality, as Beatrice discovered 3 agonizing days later, was a stubborn greystone farmhouse clinging desperately to the side of a wind-blasted Yorkshire moor. The journey had been a physical torment. 3 days crammed into the claustrophobic belly of the mail coach, surrounded by snoring merchants, and the overwhelming stench of unwashed bodies and sour cheese. Beatrice had slept in fitful snatches, her head occasionally dropping onto Thomas's shoulder when exhaustion overtook propriety. He hadn't pushed her away, but he hadn't held her either. He had remained a rigid, silent presence, radiating heat in the freezing carriage. When the hired cart finally dumped them at the iron gates of Highridge, it was twilight. The wind coming off the moors was a physical force carrying the bitter scent of wet peat and looming snow. Beatrice stood in the mud, staring at her new home. It was grim. The windows were narrow defensive slits against the weather. The roof was slate slick with freezing rain. There were no manicured hedges, no sprawling rose gardens, just endless bruised purple heather stretching into the darkening horizon. "Welcome to your kingdom," Thomas said wryly, hauling their single small portmanteau purchased hastily at the station onto his shoulder. He didn't wait for her to absorb the shock. He strode toward the heavy oak door and pushed it open. It didn't lock. Out here there was nothing worth stealing. Beatrice followed him inside.
The interior smelled of wood smoke, old mutton fat, and damp stone. The entrance hall was entirely devoid of decoration, save for a pair of muddy boots by the door and a rusted iron umbrella stand. "Mrs. Gable!" Thomas shouted, his voice echoing off the bare walls. A door at the end of the hall creaked open. An older woman stepped out, wiping her flour-covered hands on a stained apron. She was built like a brick oven, solid and severe, with a face that looked as though it had been weathered by the same storms that battered the house. "Lord Thomas." She grunted, showing absolutely no surprise at his sudden arrival. Her eyes shifted to Beatrice. They widened a fraction, taking in the ruined, mud-caked, violently out-of-place wedding gown. "You brought a stray." "I brought a wife," Thomas corrected, dropping the bag. It hit the floorboards with a dull thud. "Lady Beatrice, light a fire in the main bedroom gable and boil water, a lot of it." Mrs. Gable's jaw tightened, but she gave a curt, jerky nod. "There's only stew on the hearth. It's mostly root vegetables." "It'll do," Thomas said. He turned to Beatrice. She was swaying slightly on her feet. The adrenaline that had sustained her through the wedding, the escape and the journey had completely evaporated. She was left with a hollow, vibrating exhaustion that made her vision swim. "Go to the fire in the kitchen," he told her, his tone softening just a fraction. "I need to check the stables. The roof looked precarious last winter." "You're going back out?" she asked, her voice raspy from the cold. "Now, the animals don't care that I just got married, Beatrice." He didn't smile. He just turned and walked back out into the biting wind, leaving her standing alone in the dim, echoing hall. She found her way to the kitchen. It was marginally warmer here, dominated by a massive stone hearth where an iron pot bubbled lethargically. Mrs. Gable ignored her, aggressively stabbing at the fire with a heavy poker. Beatrice stood awkwardly near the flames. The heat hit her frozen skin, causing a wave of painful tingling in her hands and feet. She looked down at herself. The silk was ruined beyond repair, stained brown and black, the delicate lace shredded. She looked like a ghost that had been dragged through a swamp. She was the Lady of Highridge. She was a pariah. She was safe from Arthur. She sank onto a small wooden stool by the fire, burying her face in her bruised, dirty hands, and wondered if she had traded a gilded cage for a stone tomb. The bedroom was painfully cold. The fire Mrs. Gable had built in the small hearth crackled weakly, fighting a losing battle against the draft pouring through the ill-fitting window frames. Beatrice stood in the center of the braided rag rug, shivering. A tin tub of lukewarm water sat near the hearth, mocking her. She couldn't get into it. She couldn't get out of her clothes. For 20 minutes she had twisted, pulled and clawed at the back of her gown. Her mother's maid had laced the corset with the vindictive strength of a woman instructed to shave 2 inches off a waistline. The laces were knotted, the wet silk had shrunk and stiffened, and Beatrice's arms ached with a dull lactic burn from reaching behind her back. She was trapped in her own armor. The door latch clicked. Beatrice flinched instinctively, crossing her arms over her chest as Thomas walked in. He smelled intensely of wet wool horse musk and freezing air. He stopped just inside the room, taking in the scene, the steaming tub, the weak fire, and Beatrice, pale and trembling, still encased in her filthy wedding dress. He let out a heavy sigh, rubbing a hand roughly over his face. He looked ancient in the dim light, the lines around his mouth deeply carved. "I cannot undo the knots," Beatrice whispered. The admission tasted like ash. She hated being helpless. She had spent the last 3 days proving she was strong enough for this exile, and now she was defeated by a piece of string. "The silk. It shrank in the rain. My fingers are too numb." Thomas didn't mock her. He didn't offer a polite, gentlemanly apology. He just shrugged off his heavy, wet coat and let it drop to the floor. "Turn around," he said. Beatrice hesitated. In her entire life, the only men who had ever seen her unlaced were doctors. To turn her back to expose the intricate, humiliating mechanics of her undergarments to a man even her legal husband felt obscenely vulnerable. "Beatrice." Thomas's voice was tired, devoid of any predatory warmth.
I have spent the last hour pulling a stillborn foal from a freezing mare. I promise you I have no energy left for scandal. Turn around. She turned. She felt the heat of his body step close behind her. He didn't touch her skin. His large, rough fingers found the top of the gown working at the tiny, stubborn pearl buttons. He was surprisingly deft, his hands moving with a practiced mechanical efficiency. Hold your breath, he instructed quietly as he reached the rigid lacing of the corset. She inhaled deeply, filling her lungs as much as the whalebone would allow. Thomas didn't bother trying to untie the wet, hardened knots. She heard the sharp metallic snick of a pocket knife snapping open. Wait, she gasped. The dress is ruined anyway, Thomas said gruffly. She felt the cold steel slide beneath the tight laces at the small of her back. With a sudden forceful upward jerk, he slashed through the strings. The tension snapped instantly. The rigid cage of the corset sprang open, and an involuntary ragged gasp tore from Beatrice's throat as her ribs expanded to their natural width for the first time in 16 hours. The rush of air into her compressed lungs was so sudden and dizzying that her knees buckled. Thomas caught her. His large hands clamped firmly onto her waist, right over the thin cotton of her chemise. He held her upright until she found her footing. His grip was entirely functional, yet the heat of his palms seemed to sear right through the fabric, leaving an imprint on her bruised skin. Easy, he murmured, his breath warm against the nape of her neck. Beatrice nodded shakily, leaning forward to let the heavy, ruined mass of the corset and gown slide off her shoulders. It pooled around her ankles with a heavy, wet slop. She stood there in only her thin, muddy chemise and her sodden stockings. Thomas took a step back instantly, putting physical distance between them. He closed his pocket knife and slid it back into his trousers. He pointedly kept his eyes on the fire, his jaw locked tight. There's clean water in the pitcher for your face, he said, his voice gravelly and low. I'll sleep in the armchair downstairs. Beatrice looked at him over her shoulder. The room was freezing, the situation was desperate, and they were ruined. But as she took her first full, deep, unconstricted breath, the scent of smoke and old stone filling her lungs, a strange, terrifying spark of warmth flickered in her chest. She was cold. She was filthy. But she was breathing. Ah, Thomas, she said softly, stopping him as he reached for the door handle. He paused, not looking back. Yes. Thank you. He didn't reply. He just opened the door, stepped out into the dark hallway, and pulled it shut behind him, leaving her alone to wash the dirt of her old life away. December did not arrive in Yorkshire. It invaded. The cold was not a temperature, but a physical entity that lived in the corners of Highridge Manor, pressing against the walls and seeping up through the floorboards. It smelled of wet slate and old iron. For the first 3 weeks, Beatrice thought she might actually die. She did not tell Thomas this. They barely spoke. Their marriage was a negotiation of space and silence. Thomas rose before the sun plunging into the freezing dark to tend to the meager flock of sheep that kept them from outright starvation. He returned hours later, smelling of lanolin manure and frost, his knuckles split and bleeding from the wind. He would eat whatever thick, unidentifiable root stew Mrs. Gable slammed onto the table, stare at the fire for an hour, and then retreat to the small, drafty parlor to sleep on a horsehair sofa that looked like a torture device. Beatrice was left to the house. The aristocratic daughters of London were taught to play the piano forte, paint watercolors, and speak passably poor French. They were not taught how to scrub a stone floor with lye soap, or how to pluck a chicken, or how to darn a wool sock so the heel wouldn't blister. Her hands, once her greatest vanity, were the first casualties. The lye cracked the skin across her knuckles. The constant exposure to freezing water and harsh soap left her fingers raw and swollen. When she tried to sew by the weak light of a single tallow candle, she bled onto the rough wool. One Tuesday in early January, the wind was screaming across the moors, rattling the window pane so violently it sounded like musket fire. Beatrice was in the kitchen, kneeling on the hard flags, trying to coax a spark from a pile of damp peat. Her hands were shaking. She struck the flint against the steel, tearing the skin on her thumb.
A sharp, hot curse ripped from her throat. She threw the flint across the room. It clattered against the stone wall. She slumped back on her heels, pressing her bleeding thumb into her mouth, tasting rust and salt. A hot, ugly tear of pure frustration leaked from her eye. The peat needs to be stacked on its edge to catch the draft. Beatrice flinched, whipping her head around. Thomas was standing in the doorway. He was covered in a layer of fine white snow, his breath pluming in the freezing kitchen air. He looked exhausted, the skin beneath his eyes bruised with fatigue. She quickly wiped her face, her jaw setting into a rigid line. "I know how to build a fire, Thomas." "Clearly," he said flatly, looking at the dark, smoking pile of dirt. He walked over, dropping a heavy burlap sack of root vegetables onto the table. He knelt beside her. He smelled of the storm, sharp ozone, and freezing pine. He didn't ask for permission. He reached out and took her hands. Beatrice stiffened. It was the first time he had touched her since he had cut her out of her wedding dress. His calloused thumbs brushed over the cracked red skin of her knuckles, pausing on the fresh cut on her thumb. "You are ruining yourself," he said. His voice wasn't gentle. It was accusatory, thick with the guilt he refused to speak aloud. "There is a tin of badger fat in the washroom. Use it. If these get infected, we cannot afford a doctor." "I am perfectly capable of managing," she snapped, trying to pull her hands away. His grip tightened just enough to hold her. He looked up, his dark eyes locking onto hers. The fireless hearth cast harsh shadows across his broken nose and the sharp angle of his jaw. "Stop fighting me, Beatrice," he said quietly. "The winter is trying hard enough to kill us. We don't need to help it." He let go of her hands, reached into the hearth, and quickly, efficiently restacked the peat. He struck his own flint. A spark caught the dry moss at the center, and a thin, weak ribbon of orange flame licked upward. He stood up, brushing the dirt from his knees. "The badger fat," he reminded her, and walked out of the kitchen. Beatrice sat on the cold floor, the tiny fire beginning to warm her freezing face. She looked at her raw, ruined hands. The resentment that had kept her warm for a month suddenly felt very heavy and very useless. The next morning, she did not try to pretend she was still a lady playing at poverty. She tied her hair back with a piece of rough twine. She put on a heavy, scratchy wool dress Mrs. Gable had found in a trunk. She went to the washroom, found the foul-smelling badger fat, and rubbed it into her cracked skin. It burned a hot, greasy agony, but by evening the skin was softer. She started watching Mrs. Gable instead of hiding from her. She learned that adding a splash of vinegar to the boiling mutton hid the rancid taste. She learned how to patch the holes in Thomas's coat using thick wax thread that tore at her cuticles. By February, she had calluses. The silence between her and Thomas began to change. It was no longer the icy, polite silence of strangers trapped in a mistake. It became the functional, heavy silence of a garrison under siege. They operated in tandem. When he came in from the blizzard, she handed him a cup of scalding tea without a word. When she struggled to haul a bucket of water from the half-frozen well, he took the rope from her bleeding hands and pulled it up himself, leaving the bucket at her feet before returning to the barn. They were surviving. It was a brutal, ugly existence stripped of every comfort and pretense. But one evening, as Beatrice was sweeping the hearth and Thomas was mending a bridle by the fire, she caught him watching her. He didn't look away when she met his gaze. He simply observed her taking in the rough wool dress, the severe knot of her hair, the strong, competent movements of her hands. The cynical, mocking light that usually lived in his eyes was gone. In its place was something heavier, something that felt dangerously like respect. Beatrice held his stare. She felt the heat of the fire on her back, but the sudden sharp flush that traveled up her neck had nothing to do with the hearth. She turned back to the ashes, the broom handle slick in her grip. Spring did not come with blooming flowers and singing birds. It came with mud. By late March, the snowmelt turned the moors into a brown, sucking bog. The roof leaked with monotonous regularity, dripping freezing water into strategically placed tin buckets that pinged endlessly through the night. The smell of wet earth and rotting vegetation permeated everything. They were eating the last of the salted meat when the carriage arrived. Beatrice heard it first, the heavy sucking sound of hooves fighting the mud, followed by the sharp crack of a whip and the frantic whinny of a horse. She dropped her mending and went to the narrow window in the hall. Through the distortion of the cheap glass, she saw a sleek black lacquered carriage mired up to its axles in the rutted track leading to the manor. The crest of the House of Westmoreland was emblazoned in gold leaf on the door, gleaming obscenely against the drab Yorkshire landscape. A cold, heavy stone dropped into Beatrice's stomach. The air in her lungs suddenly felt thin. Thomas came out of the kitchen, wiping axle grease from his hands with a rag. He saw her face, then looked out the window. His jaw locked. The muscles in his neck pulled taut, standing out like steel cables. "Stay here," he ordered, tossing the rag onto a table. "I am not a child to be hidden," Beatrice replied immediately, her voice steady despite the frantic beating of her heart. "If Arthur sent someone, it concerns me." Thomas looked at her. He took in the defiant tilt of her chin, the hardened set of her shoulders. She was not the weeping, panicked girl he had pulled from the cathedral. She was forged from the winter now. "Fine," he grunted, "but you let me speak." They walked out the front door together. The wind whipped Beatrice's skirts around her ankles, splashing cold mud onto her boots. The carriage door opened, and a man stepped out. It was not Arthur. It was a man named Harding, Arthur's chief solicitor. He was dressed in immaculate charcoal gray wool, a stiffly starched cravat pristine at his throat. He looked at the mud, then at his polished leather boots, and his face contorted in profound disgust. He picked his way toward them like a cat crossing a puddle. Harding stopped 10 feet away, taking a perfumed handkerchief from his pocket and pressing it to his nose. The sweet, heavy scent of lavender water hit Beatrice, instantly making her nauseous. It smelled like the life she had escaped. It smelled like a cage, Lord Thomas. Harding set his voice dripping with condescension. He didn't bow. He turned his eyes to Beatrice, raking over her rough clothes, her unpowdered face, her bare red hands. "Lady Beatrice, or should I say Miss Beatrice, the matter of your title is currently under dispute." "State your business, Harding," Thomas growled. "My sheep have better manners and less stench." Harding's eyes narrowed. "I come on behalf of His Grace, the Duke of Westmoreland. He has graciously decided to offer you both an opportunity to end this embarrassing farce." Harding pulled a thick roll of vellum from his coat. The red wax seal of the Duke dangled heavily from a ribbon. "His Grace is prepared to petition the bishop for an annulment," Harding announced, his voice carrying over the wind. "On the grounds of non-consummation and coercion. He has already laid the groundwork in London. The accepted narrative is that Lord Thomas, in a fit of drunken malice, forced the lady from the altar. Lady Beatrice is viewed as a victim." Beatrice let out a short, harsh breath. It was brilliant. Arthur couldn't stand the humiliation of being left, so he was rewriting history. He wasn't the jilted groom. He was the aggrieved brother whose bride was stolen by a madman. "If you sign this petition," Harding continued, looking directly at Beatrice, "your reputation will be salvaged. Your father's debts, which His Grace has acquired, will be forgiven. You will return to London, spend 6 months in the country for your nerves, and re-enter society without a blemish." "And what of Thomas?" Beatrice asked, her voice dangerously quiet. Harding smiled. It was a thin, cruel expression. "Lord Thomas will relinquish all claims to the Westmoreland name. He will sign the deed of this establishment over to the Duke to cover the legal costs. He will be given a sum of £50 and a one-way ticket to the colonies. If he refuses, the Duke will foreclose on the mortgages he holds on this property by the end of the week. You will both be beggars in the street." The silence that followed was broken only by the whistling wind. Beatrice looked at Thomas. He was staring at the ground, his face a mask of carved granite. He didn't look angry. He looked defeated. He had fought the winter, he had fought the starvation, but he couldn't fight the crushing financial machinery of a duke. £50, Thomas said quietly to the mud. "He prices my exile quite cheaply." He looked up at Beatrice. His dark eyes were bleak, utterly stripped of hope.
It's over, Beatrice. You've survived the winter. You proved your point. Take the annulment. Go home.
Home? She whispered the word, tasting like bile.
To a father who sold me and a society that trades women like cattle that is not my home.
It is better than freezing to death in a ditch, Thomas said harshly. Sign the paper.
Beatrice looked at the solicitor. Harding was holding the vellum out of silver pen poised in his other hand. He looked incredibly smug. He represented the entire world that had told her she was nothing but a pretty quiet object meant to be owned. She stepped forward. Her heavy boots squelched in the mud. She reached out and took the vellum from Harding. The paper was thick, expensive smelling of ink and wealth.
Lady Beatrice makes the wise choice.
Harding purred.
Beatrice didn't look at the document. She looked at Harding's immaculate gray coat. Then she slowly turned her head and looked at the black, muddy ditch running alongside the carriage track. She walked over to the ditch.
What are you doing?
Harding asked, his smugness faltering.
Beatrice held the vellum out over the murky, freezing water. She didn't tear it. Tearing it would show anger. She simply let her fingers open. The heavy parchment dropped. It hit the surface of the mud with a flat smack. The thick ink immediately began to run the red wax seal, sinking heavily into the brown sludge. Harding gasped, taking a horrified step forward, heedless of his boots.
Are you insane? Do you know what you've just done?
I have answered the Duke, Beatrice said smoothly.
She turned back to Harding. The wind whipped her loose hair across her face, but she didn't brush it away. She stared at him with eyes as cold and hard as the stone of High Ridge.
You tell Arthur, she said, her voice ringing with absolute chilling clarity, that if he tries to foreclose on this land, I will write letters to the editors of every major paper in London. I will detail exactly why I walked away from his altar. I will describe his temper, his cruelty, and his profound inadequacies as a man.
Harding's face drained of color.
You wouldn't dare. You would ruin yourself.
I am already ruined. Beatrice laughed a loud, sharp sound that startled the carriage horse.
I live in the mud, Mr. Harding. I pluck my own chickens, and I freeze every night. What more can Arthur take from me?
My reputation, he can have it. But I promise you, I will drag his pride into the muck right beside me. He will be the laughing stock of the peerage, the duke whose bride preferred a penniless sheep farmer.
She stepped closer to Harding, forcing the man to back away into a puddle.
You tell him, she whispered, that if he leaves us be, we will disappear. But if he pushes, I will burn his dignity to ash. Now get off our land.
Harding stared at her, his mouth opening and closing soundlessly. He looked at Thomas seeking intervention, but Thomas was staring at Beatrice with an expression of absolute stunned awe.
Harding swallowed hard, turned on his heel, and scrambled into the carriage. He yelled at the driver. The driver cracked the whip brutally, and with a sickening lurch, the carriage tore itself free of the mud and began the slow, agonizing trudge back down the road.
Beatrice stood in the cold wind watching it go. Her heart was hammering against her ribs so hard she thought they might crack. Her hands were shaking violently. The adrenaline was draining, leaving behind a terrifying vacuum. She had just declared war on a duke. She had just destroyed her only way back. She closed her eyes, breathing in the smell of the wet earth.
Are you completely out of your mind?
Thomas's voice was a low, rough rumble behind her.
Beatrice opened her eyes. She turned around slowly.
Thomas was standing right behind her. He wasn't keeping his distance anymore. The space between them had vanished. His chest was heaving. His dark eyes were practically burning, fixed on her face, as if he were seeing her for the very first time.
Probably, Beatrice breathed. He offered you an escape, a clean slate.
His voice was harsh, grating against the wind.
Why didn't you take it?
Because I don't want a clean slate, she said, stepping into his space.
She tilted her head back to look at him. She didn't care about the mud on her skirt or the wind in her hair.
I want my life, and my life is here.
Thomas stared at her. The muscles in his jaw tightened so hard they trembled. For months, he had treated her like a fragile liability. He had expected her to shatter, but she hadn't shattered. She had turned to steel. He moved so fast she didn't have time to blink. His large, grease-stained hands came up framing her face. He didn't ask. He just pulled her to him. His mouth crashed down onto hers. It wasn't the awkward, hesitant kiss from the cathedral. It was desperate bruising and hungry. It tasted of rain and adrenaline and a violently suppressed need that had been simmering for 4 freezing months. Beatrice gasped against his lips, the shock of it vibrating down to her toes. Then she pushed back. She grabbed the lapels of his worn coat, her fingers twisting into the rough wool, pulling him closer, deepening the kiss. She met his ferocity with her own. He backed her up. They stumbled blindly over the uneven ground boots, slipping in the mud lips, never parting. He hit the heavy oak door of the manor with his shoulder, throwing it open, and practically carried her into the dim, cold hallway. He slammed the door shut with his boot cutting off the wind. The sudden quiet of the hall was filled only with the sound of their ragged breathing. Thomas pulled away just an inch. He was staring down at her, his chest rising and falling heavily. His eyes were entirely black in the shadows. He said the annulment was based on non-consummation. Thomas murmured, his breath hot against her mouth. His voice was completely stripped of his usual cynical armor. It was raw, and it was demanding. Arthur is a liar, Beatrice whispered fiercely, her hands sliding up from his lapels to tangle in his dark, untidy hair. Make him a liar, Thomas let out a low groan. He didn't carry her up the stairs like a romantic hero. He grabbed her hand, dragging her up the narrow, creaking wooden steps, their boots clattering loudly in the empty house. The bedroom was freezing. The fire had died down to a few glowing embers. They didn't care. The frantic urgency between them burned hot enough to push back the chill. There was no delicate unlacing of corsets, no soft romantic lighting. There was only the clumsy, desperate need to strip away the barriers between them. Thomas's hands shook as he fumbled with the tiny buttons of her wool dress. Beatrice didn't wait for him to finish. She tore at his cravat, pulling the sodden fabric from his neck, her fingers rushing to unbutton his shirt. When the heavy layers of damp wool and cotton finally fell to the floor, the cold air hit Beatrice's bare skin, making her shiver violently. But then Thomas pressed against her, and the heat of his solid, heavily muscled body enveloped her. His skin was rough-scarred from a lifetime of labor, smelling of salt and hard work. He backed her toward the heavy four-poster bed. The mattress was stuffed with horsehair, and the blankets were coarse wool, but when he laid her down, it felt like the center of the earth. He hovered over her, his forearms bracketing her head. The cynic was gone. The shadow of the Duke was gone. He looked down at her, tracing the line of her cheekbone with a calloused thumb. I have nothing to give you. He said, his voice a hoarse rasp. It was his final defense, his last warning. I am a ruined man on a ruined farm. Beatrice reached up, wrapping her arms around his neck, pulling his weight down onto her. You gave me the only thing I ever wanted, Thomas, she whispered against his mouth. You gave me a choice. Now take me. The consummation of their marriage was not a gentle, poetic affair. It was a collision. It was the physical release of 4 months of terror, cold and unspoken longing. It was messy and urgent and entirely real. When Beatrice cried out, it wasn't in pain, but in a sudden blinding surge of grounding reality. Thomas buried his face in her neck, his hands gripping her hips with a possessive strength that anchored her to the earth. They moved together with a ragged, unpolished rhythm, fighting the cold, fighting the past, fighting the ghosts of the life they had burned to the ground. They didn't make love. They forged an alliance in the dark. When Beatrice woke, the room was blindingly bright. She blinked against the harsh light, her eyes adjusting slowly. The storm had broken. Sunlight was pouring through the narrow slit of the window, reflecting off a fresh, brilliant layer of spring snow that blanketed the moors. She shifted, a deep, unfamiliar ache settling into her thighs and back. The bed beside her was empty. Panic flared in her chest for a fraction of a second, an old reflex from a world where men always left. But then she smelled it, coffee, and burning wood, she sat up pulling the scratchy wool blanket to her collarbone. The door to the bedroom was slightly ajar. Downstairs, she could hear the rhythmic clack-clack of Mrs. Gable working the butter churn, and the low, steady sound of Thomas's voice murmuring to the sheepdog. Beatrice looked down at her left hand. The heavy gold ring of the Duke of Westmoreland, the one she had jammed onto Thomas's finger, was gone. In its place, resting on the bedside table, was a plain, slightly irregular iron band. She reached out and picked it up. It was heavy, dark, and perfectly simple. She knew what it was. It was a link cut from the old chain in the barn, filed down and smoothed by hand. Thomas must have spent hours working it in the dark. She slid it onto her ring finger. It fit perfectly. It was cold at first, but it quickly warmed against her skin. Beatrice threw the blankets off and stood up. The cold air bit at her bare skin, but she didn't shiver. She pulled on her heavy chemise and a thick wool shawl. She didn't bother to find a mirror to pin her hair. She let it fall loose down her back, a wild, tangled mess. She walked downstairs barefoot. The floorboards were freezing, but she liked the sting of it. It meant she was awake. The kitchen was warm. The hearth fire was roaring, stacked expertly on edge. Thomas was sitting at the heavy wooden table. He was wearing a clean shirt, his hair damp from washing at the pump. He was holding a chipped mug of coffee, staring out the window at the glaring white expanse of the moor. He didn't turn around as she entered, but she saw the tension leave his shoulders at the sound of her footsteps. Beatrice walked over to him. She didn't say good morning. She didn't ask for a declaration of love. She simply stepped behind his chair, wrapped her arms around his neck, and pressed her cheek against his back. He was solid. He was real. Thomas let out a long, slow breath. He reached up, his large, rough hand covering hers where it rested against his chest. His thumb brushed over the crude iron ring. "The snow is melting," Thomas said quietly, his voice vibrating through his chest and into her skin. "The lower pasture will be accessible by tomorrow. We need to shear the ewes before the damp gets to their coats," Beatrice replied, her voice steady and practical. Thomas turned his head, looking at her over his shoulder. The harsh morning light illuminated the broken bridge of his nose, the deep lines around his eyes, and the quiet, fierce devotion that had finally burned through his cynicism. "Yes," he said softly, "we do." Beatrice squeezed him tighter. They were not a duke and a duchess. They were not wealthy. They were not respected. And they were entirely forgotten by the world that had tried to consume them. They were a man and a woman in a stone house on a bitter moor with nothing but mud sheep and the unbreakable iron of their own will. And for the first time in her life, Beatrice was exactly where she belonged. And that is how Beatrice traded a gilded cage for an iron ring. If her choice to burn her past and fight for her freedom in the freezing mud gave you chills, hit that like button. Subscribe to the channel for more raw, gritty historical dramas where the characters actually bleed for their happy endings. Share this story with a fellow romance lover who prefers a hero with calloused hands and a heroine with a spine of steel. Before you go, drop a comment below. Would you have taken the Duke's annulment or stayed for the iron? Let me know